This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
We just can't seem to get enough of musical biopics.
It's going to happen one of these days.
From charting the rise and fall of Amy Winehouse to Kurt Cobain, Edith Piaf to NWA, studios can be confident of a return on investment at the box office.
Look, Ray, let's not do nothing stupid.
I might be blind, but I ain't stupid.
Audiences even love the satirical movies that mock the genre. Walk hard. But they're tricky to get right. You need great acting, singing or miming, and clever storytelling if you're diverging from the truth. I'm Saoirse Pollock, and this is In the News from the Irish Times. Today, why we love the musical biopic and what separates a showstopper from a bum note. Donald, we started off there with a clip from the trailer of the Amy Winehouse movie Back to Black. You've seen it. Is it any good?
It's fine. I mean, we know the structure of these things. This is as a result of so many rock star lives being similar to a certain extent. But nonetheless, there should be more imaginative ways of doing it. Nonetheless, we have fallen into this trap of... The filmmakers have fallen into this trap of giving us films which follow these same cliched structures over and over again, which is the surprising rise from nowhere, the inspirational success, the drinking drugs hell, and then either redemption or death, depending upon how things worked out. Within that rather familiar shape, it's actually not bad. And I think it probably helps that there's an awful lot of bad publicity around this as a result of two or three poorly edited trailers that came out beforehand, which seemed to suggest they had problems with, well, Marissa Abella's singing for a start, which actually, in fact, turns out to be fine in the film itself, and with, again, just like relying far too much on those cliches. But within that template, it's actually, I think, pretty efficient, and it gets certain things. It has the good sense to hang around North London for most of its duration. So rather than kind of flinging her into the wild world of Los Angeles or wherever it might be, it has a chance to engage the North London milieu from which she came, and I think it gets that quite nicely. That's the kind of world of lager and fags and pool halls that she emerged from very effectively. You can kind of like smell the lager on bays all throughout. I think that's all done very well. I think the family around her are good. Leslie Manville, I think, is particularly good as her inspirational grandmother. It's all of which is a bit sentimental, but I think sincerely acted. I think Jack O'Connell's great, who plays the erstwhile husband, Blake, who... was, depending upon who you read, the source of a lot of her problems or not. He does enough to communicate to us why she may have been attracted to him without falling into sort of Stockholm syndrome, as actors sometimes do in these circumstances, and trying to make him into a lovable character with whom we're supposed to identify, which he certainly doesn't. But for all that, I think I can't think of a tremendous reason to watch this rather than Aziz Kabalia's excellent documentary, which came out about 7 or 8 years
ago. But this was my immediate thought when I saw that this movie was coming out. I thought, why would anyone want to watch this following the success of the documentary?
As I say, if you're asking that question about one of these films, of which we'll go on to in a minute, which there are many, and there are many more to come, then they've probably got it wrong. I think the ones that do it best are the ones where they have done something imaginative with the structure, that they've given you something that really only a drama film, only something that is not a documentary can do, that something creative in a kind of quasi-fictional sense. Those are the ones that are actually worth seeking out. I mean, the example I would come back to again and again is Todd Haynes' I'm Not There about Bob Dylan.
There he lay, poet, prophet, outlaw, fake, star of electricity, even the ghost was more than one person.
He examined several stages of Bob Dylan's life through fictionalized versions, including Cate Blanchett at one stage playing this version of Bob Dylan. Where, even if you don't like I'm Not There, I mean, you wouldn't emerge from it and say, like, why the hell wouldn't you just watch Martin Scorsese's No Direction Home? Because they're entirely different things. That's why. It's not just a linear walk through the story. And I think in the case of Back to Black, though I thought it was, you know, perfectly enjoyable, and I think they did make a drama of it, and I enjoyed all the performances, you do still walk out saying, well, that was still basically a linear walk through the story, and if I'd watched Kabalia's Amy, then not only would I get a better version of that, but also I could hear the original songs, because This is another thing that you have with these films. There's always a decision they have come to at some point, mime or not to mime. And there are arguments on both sides. I mean, obviously, if you are... it's funny enough, you know, sort of 40, 50 years ago, this was completely accepted. I mean, Marnie Nixon, the famous performer who...
did all the big musicals.
Did the voices of Audrey Hepburn, did the voice of Deborah Carr, did the voice of Natalie Wood, and no one minded a jot. It was completely normal. However, in the modern day, we are now kind of expecting a greater degree of authenticity. So it does jar a little when someone opens their mouth and someone else's voice comes out. But at the same time, you watch Back to Black, and though the actress has a perfectly decent voice. I mean, I think Bella does pretty well with it. In this case, because you're living gymnastically spectacular voice, in the case of Amy Winehouse, you know, a pretty good voice won't do. Even that, it's interesting, you watch something like Aretha, the Aretha Franklin film with Jennifer Hudson. Jennifer Hudson has a tremendous voice, but again, it's not Aretha Franklin's. Aretha Franklin's voice, again, is so spectacular that you notice the loss.
I want to talk a little more about these musical biopics because I know they've been happening for years, but it does suddenly feel like there's a lot of them around. Mm-hmm. I mean, one might want to speak about Bohemian Rhapsody, very mixed feelings about that. But then you've got in recent years, Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, the Bob Marley, One Love. Why are they becoming more popular, or is this just something that continues to happen?
Well, they're certainly not going away. I mean, I don't know if they're becoming more popular, but certainly we're I think we probably are in a particularly fecund period for them. And that's because of fans. I mean, the traditional musicals can be a hard sell. It's a funny one with traditional musicals, which I mean, you know, ones with non-diegetic sound, where people start warbling in the middle of an emotional scene. People fall in love with them, then fall out of love with them again. You go through a period where after Mamma Mia, for example, which admittedly was kind of a hybrid, the musical is back. Then you had The Greatest Showman, and that. But then again, then you have, you know, films like In the Heights, which is a flop. You had the musical version of The Color Purple, which is a flop. So it's all, and they're quite expensive things to make. So those traditional musicals are a dicey bet.
Yeah.
Always, you never quite know how the public sits on that form. However, with a jukebox musical, which actually Mamma Mia was, obviously, in its way, more accurately, with a biopic that acts as a jukebox musical because you get the songs of that particular artist all the way through, you have a ready-made fan base waiting for it right there.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, the specific film that we can blame, that's the word in this context, is Bohemian Rhapsody. Mm.
That's quite a cool riff, actually. You wrote that?
That's really good.
Yes, it will be.
If you all can just shut up and play.
Which won more Oscars for somehow than any other film in the 2019 ceremony, which seems extraordinary. Took nearly $1 billion. I think with the best film in the world, even its fans would probably admit that is more to do with the continuing popularity of Queen than any particular brilliance in the filmmaking. And as ever, William Goldman's famous dictum about nobody knows anything, Hollywood's response to one success is to try and replicate that with exactly the same film with a few tweaks here and there. So that probably allowed Baz Luhrmann to make Elvis, which was a more imaginative film than Bohemian Rhapsody, and that did fine. It got 8 Oscar nominations. It took about $290 million, I think.
I enjoyed that
one. It made a star of Austin Butler.
Well, you may go to college.
Them girls won't see you wiggle. Move, man.
So that demonstrated that there was that confirmed that there was legs in that format. Then, as you say, we had the Whitney Houston film. Last year was fine. And this year we have the real puzzler in this year's box office so far, and we're past the first quarter, as they say in business, so we can probably have a conversation about that, is the success of Bob Marley, One Love.
Reggae is the people music.
Which arrived to indifferent reviews. It seemed to me nothing special. In fact, actually quite corny for most of its duration. And it's done spectacularly well. I mean, it is a fourth or fifth biggest highest grossing film worldwide of the year so far. Taking about $177 million, which would not be an enormous amount in the old money, but in the current post-COVID era, that's plenty. One thing to point about all these films is they almost always have great performances at the centre. The producers know that much. The one thing they have to get right is find somebody who, even if they can't quite emulate the belting sound of the performer that they're playing, at least has the charisma and the terpsichorean gifts dance around when required. And I mean, so for example, I think in the case of One Love, Kingsley Benadire was really terrific in the role. Naomi Ackie was great in the Whitney Houston one, though that didn't do great business. And once you have that core, then you could build the songs around them. That core is solid, and then people will come if there are sufficient fans around, which it seems there are of Bob Marley. Who knew?
I'll continue my chat with Donald Clark after this short break.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And what about you, Donald? I mean, you've seen so many of these over the years. I mean, looking back, which are the musical biopics that stand out for you? And then we've referenced Bohemian Rhapsody, but are there others that just really did not get it right at all?
Obviously, when you have this conversation with yourself, you're always kind of, there's this issue about, like, to what extent you can properly appreciate a biopic of a musician you don't much care for. I mean, I don't honestly imagine I'm going to walk into a biopic of Emerson, Lake and Palmer with any great enthusiasm, or whoever. But having said that, for example, Todd Haynes' album up there would be, for me, somebody's classic example. I also happen to be a Dylan freak, so that kind of works on both levels. As it happens, as we've already mentioned, it's a very imaginative take on barely a biopic at all. I mean, it is an essay on the art of being Bob Dylan. That comes with, in my case, you know, my personal passion for Bob Dylan. That works. I mean, I wouldn't call myself the world's biggest Elton John fan, but in terms of recent biopics, I would really recommend Rocket Man.
My name is Elton Hercules John, and I'm an alcoholic, and a cocaine addict, and a sex addict, and a bulimic. I'm also a shopaholic who has problems with weed, prescription drugs, and anger management.
Which had the guts to go back and do a traditional musical, so Tarnation actually does burst into song throughout the piece at various moments, that you have a huge dance number based staged around Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting and other numbers. That seemed to me a terrific example of what they're doing. But you know what? At the end of the day, it made about a fifth of what Bohemian Rhapsody made. I think it made sort of somewhere closing in on 200 million as opposed to close to a billion, which is what Bohemian Rhapsody made. So does that again just tell us that Elton John is less popular than Queen? Maybe. But I think it also does say that if it doesn't show to us people are happier with the traditional, less imaginative form, it does show that they are happy enough with it, that they'll go and see that and not demand anything more from it. But those are two recentish ones that I would recommend. I think Clint Eastwood's Bird is one that's sometimes overlooked. That's a fine film about Charlie Parker from the late 80s with Forest Whitaker in a central performance. And that's one, I think, if you're asking the question, give me an example of one of these films that I can enjoy even if I've no time or even haven't even heard of the musician involved. And I think Bird is probably one. I don't think you have to be a huge bebop fan to connect with that. I mean, it is a story, a universal story of the decline of an art, which again, I would say, again, has a drinking drugs hell and all the stuff we mentioned earlier on, but obviously pitched a different level that you're dealing with a jazz musician.
What about films like Walk the Line and Ray? They did.
Well, it's funny, one thing we haven't mentioned yet, actually, you mentioned Walk the Line and Ray, that the urtext, in a certain extent, for these things is actually a pastiche, is Walk Hard, the Judy Cox story from way back in 2007.
Some people are saying that your new music sounds a lot like Bob Dylan.
Well, maybe Bob Dylan sounds a lot like me. You know, how come nobody ever asked Bob Dylan why you sound so much like Dewey Cox?
Mailboxes drip like lampposts in the twisted birth canal of the Coliseum.
And Jake Kasdan's film with John C. Reilly as a compendium of all the various musicians who to that point had had their biopics told in this conventional fashion that we said it's really, really funny film. One of those films that I don't think did great business on release, but has hung around on DVD and on streaming and has become kind of
cultish.
And same with Spinal Tap, actually, which, you know, fits, which did the same for the Rock documentary, you know, kind of 30, 40 years earlier. And Walkhard kind of sprung, I think, a little bit from reactions to Ray and to Walk the Line. I wasn't the only person who said or wrote at the time that it is remarkable that two such different men as Johnny Cash and Ray Charles can generate two eerily similar films. Men who came from such different backgrounds, his music was very different, could basically end up having almost interchangeable characters in those two films.
The only place you're allowed to speak to me is on stage. Do you understand?
What did I do?
I don't know. Why didn't you ask your big fat shadow?
Come on, baby.
Come on, baby. Baby, 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 baby.
However, having said all that, I mean, there were two examples of films which actually worked within that cliched structure very, very effectively. Big budgeted films with huge performances at the center, from Joaquin Phoenix and Jamie Foxx, which obviously helped a lot. Both won acting Oscars. Fox won, and also Reese Witherspoon won for Walk the Line. So, I mean, I think those films didn't break any new ground, but I think they were carried off with such professionalism that it didn't matter that much. I mean, those are kind of the Rolls-Royce end of the unchallenging traditional biopic. So I think those are two good films that hold up.
We've touched on films that spoof the musical biopic, but are there any others that jump out of you that really took advantage of the genre and turned it around?
It's tricky again to be honest with yourself about to what extent you're viewing the filmmaking alone and setting that aside from your feelings about the performer. But two from very much my generation, in fact, about the same musicians to a large extent, are Michael Winterbottom's 24-Hour Party People.
Tony, there's two Tonys.
Yeah.
Well, that straight away, can you not see how that's a potential problem? You've got two people, he's in charge of the club, I'm supposed to be in charge of whatever it is we're doing. There's two Tonys on equal pegging. It's a confrontation. You know, who's Tony number one, who's Tony number two? There's going to have to be some sort of differentiation.
Yeah, but he's not called Tony, is he? He's called Tony.
Which is actually more a biopic about a label owner, and Tony Wilson, played by Steve Coogan, who was the man who set up Factory Records in Manchester in the late 1970s and was the godfather of Joy Division and then later on Happy Mondays. No, that's a tremendously good film. And I think probably you could enjoy it if you'd no great interest in Joy Division and Happy Mondays. Maybe not, I don't know. I think you probably could because it's really funny. I mean, you're essentially getting one of Steve Coogan's classic buffoons.
Yeah.
In this case, actually, Wilson was an intelligent guy. He wasn't an Alan Partridge, and he wasn't a jerk like many of the people who he plays. But you get that from it. The other Joy Division film, Control by Anton Corbijn, with Sam Riley as Ian Curtis, is also, I think, terrific, made in black and white, beautifully framed film that gets at the aesthetic of not just of Joy Division's music, but also of the visuals that surrounded them at that time, some of which were created by Anton Corbijn, who emerged first as a photographer for the NME and so forth. I think those are two interesting films that I would definitely recommend checking out. And, you know, there's also, we kind of forget, these things go way back. I mean, things like the Glenn Miller story, you know, from with Jimmy Stewart.
It's the truest and warmest love story that ever happened. There were the tough years and the good years, but out of their love came music such as the world had never heard before, and that millions of Americans still love.
Oh, enormous popular. I mean, you know, the Al Jolson story, these things have always been around. They've changed form, they've shifted from one thing to another, but they've always been around in one form or another. And, you know, in terms of things that are coming up, we haven't got around to that yet, they're not going away. You know, we've got Michael Jackson.
I've heard this. We've got, I mean, how will something like that be treated?
Well, interesting. I mean, it's Antoine Fuqua, who is no fool. He's an intelligent professional filmmaker. He's got his nephew, I think it's Jermaine Jackson's son, I think. Do I have that right? Look it up, I've got it wrong.
Okay.
But playing Michael Jackson in that. It'll be very interesting to see that how they dance around that subject. And as we speak, there's an awful lot of attention being played around the place to photographs of Timothée Chalamet in the next Bob Dylan biopic, which is called Complete Unknown. I knew it was something from like a Rolling Stone. Which obviously makes more sense. Of course, Donald, Complete Unknown, because it's the early days, use your head. But another one, which is really fascinating, and I don't know, is it a good idea, is the four Beatles films telling the story from each of the four band members being made by Sam Mendes, which he announced 2 or 3 months ago, which will all be released in the same year, I think, if I remember this correctly. Four films telling the same story from four different perspectives, which is one of those things where you think, like, God, the first one's a dud. How are they going to react to selling the three that are still to come?
Yeah.
But all of which is where we came in on this, is like, they are not going away. There's a feeling that inbuilt audience that you have for the Beatles, for Michael Jackson, for Bob Dylan, is going to flog these things, going to do enough work for you that the film only has to be good enough to break even.
But Michael Jackson's no longer with us. Members of the Beatles are no longer with us. Mm-hmm. What are your feelings on the biopics that are created around people who are still alive and well and playing music in some cases?
Well, I think Rocketman's an interesting one, because Rocketman is pretty honest about, despite being, you know, a fantastical musical that on a very heightened plane, is pretty honest about, you know, about Elton's substance abuse, for example, down through the years. So they can be quite frank. But you do tend to notice, I think, that the people who are still alive in these things do, funnily enough, tend to be treated with some generosity, or at least with kid gloves. Clive Davis, who's the founder of Arista Records, who was a producer on the Whitney Houston film, interestingly, and, well, you know, Stanley Tucci plays him a lovable old granddad all the way throughout. Surely a coincidence. Only a coincidence, I'm sure, and nothing to do with the fact that he's a producer and still alive, still with us. James Norton plays Chris Blackwell, in the founder of Island Records, in One Love, the Bob Marley film. And again, he's sort of this kind of, you know, wise figure who flits down every now and then to offer Bob sage advice. But yes, your implication is a fair one. I think the film's about people who are still with us. And there was certainly a lot of questions to be asked about the Queen film, about the Freddie film. The first phrase isn't long with us, but most of the band are. That certainly kind of glossed over certain issues that, which is maybe fair enough. But I think, yes, there are sensitivities about those films which are flogging somebody who was still in the recording studio that you maybe don't get when the person is safely in another place.
Finally, Donald, I have to ask, which is the biopic that you think still remains to be made? Is there one person that we haven't thought of?
That's an interesting one. I suppose the obvious one, I would say, staring you in the face, is David Bowie.
I know when to go out, know when to stay in, get things done.
I don't know if I want to see it, really, unless someone does something completely freaky with it, as I say.
Which is what you'd need with David Bowie.
Yeah, I mean, I mean that jumps out at me. I mean, I would love to see a Scott Walker film. I think that could be interesting, because that was a fascinating career about a man who emerged as a crooner of the old school, and then ended his career. The last 20, 30 years of his career was like wailing manically down a megaphone and hammering slabs of meat in the studio and all that stuff. I think very interesting. This is not answering your question, but I think to demonstrate again how you can tackle those towards interestingly. If someone finds a way of doing David Bowie in an imaginative fashion that does not fall back on that sort of cliche, I'll be there.
We'll have to wait and see. Donald Clark, thanks so much for your time today. That's all for today. For more of Donald Clark's film coverage and reviews, subscribe at irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Saoirse Pollock. Today's episode was produced by Aideen Finnegan and Suzanne Brennan. In the News, we'll be back tomorrow.